This episode of Lines of Inquiry is supported by Shopify. Many people carry the same thought for years, a business idea, a product they believe in, something they'd like to build themselves. But very often, the doubts arrive just as quickly. What if I don't have the technical skills? What if I don't know how to build a website? What if I can't manage everything on my own? Those questions stop a lot of ideas before they ever begin. That's where Shopify comes in. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world, from household names to brands just getting started. If you're worried about building a website, Shopify provides modern, professional, ready-to-use templates that help you create the perfect online shop from day one. If you need help with everyday tasks, Shopify's AI tools can assist with product descriptions, improving product images, and generating promotional offers. And when it comes to finding customers, Shopify helps you reach them through simple email and social media marketing campaigns. If you ever need support, Shopify also offers award-winning customer service, available 24 hours a day. So those what-ifs don't have to stop you. They can become the beginning of something. Sign up for your €1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.ie. Go to shopify.ie. This podcast is supported by advertisement from Shopify that allows us to create new episodes for you every week. Their support helps us to tell important stories. I would appreciate it if you could support the businesses who support this podcast. See what you can accomplish with Shopify by your side. Shopify.ie. A doorbell rings at a house in a quiet estate in Leixlip, County Kildare. Patrick Criégeau rises from his chair in the back garden. The sun is shining. Opening the door, he sees a boy he doesn't recognize. The boy asks to see his daughter. Was she in? He has some news for her. Patrick calls his child. There's movement on the floor above. She's on her way. He looks up and smiles as his beautiful daughter bounds down the stairs towards him. Are you sure it's for me? She asks with a perplexed look on her face. At 14, the girl is athletic and tall, taller than Patrick even. And she is smiling. Someone has called over for her. Someone her own age, wanting to chat to her. Someone at her door waiting for her. Patrick walks away. He is happy to see his daughter so excited. She doesn't have many friends. She doesn't get many visitors. Whatever the boy says convinces her to head out for a while. Patrick can't tell what is said. She runs upstairs to grab her favorite black hoodie. As she returns, Patrick tells her to be back soon. She has exams to study for, he reminds her. I won't be long, she answers. The door shuts. Patrick realizes he didn't ask where she is going. When a person is killed in Ireland, the Gardaí turn to the forensic examiners of the Technical Bureau. For 25 years, I was one of them. I'm John Sweetman. At crime scenes, I learned to listen to what the evidence was saying and what the killer was trying to silence. A smudged print, a misplaced everyday object, the smallest detail that revealed the truth. Now in this Go Loud original podcast, I return to some of Ireland's most compelling cases. This is Lines of Inquiry, a podcast that follows the evidence and reveals the story behind each case. In this episode, we hear of a case that shocked Ireland unlike any other. The shocking murder of 14-year-old Anna Criégeau, and the ensuing investigation that identified two potential killers unlike any Ireland had known before. This is Lines of Inquiry, Anna Criégeau. The 13th of May, 2018, was set aside for cramming in the Criégeau household. 14-year-old Anna had end-of-term exams around the corner. Some last-minute swatting was needed, and Geraldine, Anna's mother, could help. But Anna thought her mother must be tired. Studying was put on the long finger as mother and daughter cuddled up together to eat popcorn and watch a movie.
She chose Alvin and the Chipmunks. Later, they were busy. Family came over, pizzas were ordered, and chatter and laughter spilled out from the house and into the garden. Anna looked older for her age. Sometimes she was mistaken for an 18-year-old because of her height. At 5'8", with black shoulder-length hair, sallow skin and a slim build, she was a striking young girl. Her parents and relatives sipped drinks in the conservatory, so Anna and a cousin went to her room to record a video for her YouTube channel. She loved social media. She would share beauty tips or dance. It was thrilling to post her content. She had 100 followers on YouTube. That night, Anna asked her mother to wake her up before she left for work. She wanted to say goodbye to her before she went. But she also did something else, a nighttime routine she never missed, where she would kiss her mother and father goodnight with a lovely message in French. Her father, Patrick, had passed on his love of his birth country and language to his daughter. Her nocturnal words were always the same. Bonne nuit, dors bien, fais de beaux rêves, je t'aime. Good night, sleep tight, have beautiful dreams, I love you. Anastasia Anna Kriegel was born in February 2004 in the industrial city of Novokuznetsk in western Siberia. She was placed in an orphanage. Back in Ireland, Geraldine and Patrick Kriegel wanted a child. They were a professional couple who married in 1989. Geraldine described their marriage as a beautiful poem that became the story of our lives together. When they moved to Leixlip in North Kildare, it was a village that gradually exploded in size during Ireland's Celtic Tiger. Just 3 kilometres away is Lucan, another commuter town, but in Dublin. In between them is a vast parkland called St. Catherine's Park, with its 200 acres spread across Kildare and Dublin. The Kriegel home was just a short walk from the park. Baby Anna was adopted on the 10th of August 2006 at the age of 2.5. Geraldine said it was the happiest day of their lives. Indeed, the family always celebrated 2 important dates in their calendar: Anna's birthday and her adoption date. But there were some teething issues. The toddler was late adopting English as her first language. It meant she was playing catch-up with children of the same age. And those language delays followed her into her early years of school. There were also issues with her hearing, and she needed glasses for her eyesight. While Anna was incredibly good at sports like swimming and gymnastics, she didn't quite fit in socially. At primary school, she had a resource teacher. She was impulsive and energetic, and perhaps tried too hard to make friends, a job made more difficult by her height. Anna had uncomfortable growth spurts too, where her bones grew faster than her muscles. Anna felt left out. One time she told a teacher she was suicidal. After meeting with Pieta House, the suicide charity, it was determined that Anna was simply unhappy at school. She then attended counselling sessions locally, and afterwards Patrick would be there to pick her up and bring her home safely. Anna was afraid she would be targeted by bullies if she went home alone. And there was more. Anna was cyberbullied. She was already active across platforms like YouTube, Snapchat, and Instagram. For many a socially awkward teenager, posting online was a form of self-expression. "I love to sing, dance, swim, family and friends," she wrote on her profile. "If you're a hater, then please leave my account. Stay strong." She signed off with a heart emoji. Not all of what she wrote was well received. Some comments taunted and teased the girl over her height and looks. Others went further. One post said that she should go die. Even more disturbing were the ages of some of her bullies. That summer, before she began her new secondary school at Clonfay Community College in Leixlip, some third-year students began threatening her, saying how they could have Anna executed. They made deeply personal and hurtful comments around her adoption and referred to her parents as a fake mom and dad. When Geraldine and Patrick heard about this, they intervened. Some of the content was sexual too, and it frightened them. They took screenshots and spoke to the school. Just before Anna started secondary school in September 2017, Geraldine got a call from Anna's old primary school resource teacher. She told Geraldine she was worried for Anna. She was vulnerable and innocent, she said, and the other children might, as she put it, make a mockery out of her. One of Anna's first exercises at her new school was to write about her hopes for the future. My hopes for the future. I hoped I would get into my secondary school, and I did. That is one goal down. My second hope is to go to Paris University like my dad, the hardest one to get into. And when I come home from Paris, I would like to get a dog. I would like to get married too. Not sure I want any babies. Well, not yet, anyway. I hope that I have a good life. I hope that everyone I meet will be nice. Despite choir practice, a dance group, and even modelling at her school fundraiser, Anna remained lonely in secondary school. Girls would walk home together in groups, but Anna was never among them. On her way home from a school disco one Halloween, Anna had a terrifying experience. She had been supervising a dance organised by her dance group for younger children when four boys walked up to her and started taunting her. One of them asked her if she wanted to have sex with him. He slapped her bottom. Anna ran home and told her parents. She was frightened. Geraldine had to hold her young daughter for an hour before she calmed down. Her parents worried Anna craved attention. She set up fake social media accounts where she sent bullying comments to herself. When Geraldine and Patrick found out, they were furious and demanded passwords for all her accounts. Anna was angry at having to hand over her iPad and phone at night too, but Geraldine was glad she did. Anna's online activity was worrying. One image on her phone showed Anna tied to a chair and blindfolded. Geraldine was horrified, but Anna shrugged it off as a prank. She did it with a friend. It was all a pretense. It was just to attract the attention of another boy, to see if he would rescue her. Anna had self-harmed once. Geraldine couldn't be sure if it was a cry for help, or because of encouragement from a friend who had sent her online images of self-harming. Patrick told Geraldine that Anna felt invisible. And not just invisible, Anna felt frustrated too and started to lash out. She got into fights at school. She wanted to be noticed so badly that one day she pretended she had a black eye, using makeup. Behaviour like this earned her a half-day suspension. Geraldine knew Anna was in pain. She wanted friends. Anna did look different to her peers. Her body was more developed than the other girls her age, and some of the other children thought her clothes were too revealing. She wore makeup, and she experimented with different styles in how she dressed and wore her hair. On the morning of Monday, the 13th of May, 2018, Geraldine woke her daughter. Anna asked her mother for a note for school. She needed it to leave early for a counselling session that afternoon. Geraldine obliged and kissed her daughter goodbye. After counselling, and with Patrick heading out to the garden to soak up some sun on another beautiful day, Anna called her mother. It was just after 4 p.m, but there was no answer. Anna was in her room when the doorbell rang at 4:55 in the afternoon. The boy at the door asked Patrick if Anna was home. Patrick called upstairs to her and shortly after watched as she left with the boy whose name he didn't know. She wouldn't be long. Patrick believed her. St. Catherine's Park was busy that afternoon in May 2018. People walked on their way home. Others were out for a leisurely stroll. CCTV cameras working that day captured images across it. Just before 5 o'clock, a boy walked into the park through an entrance known as Courtyard Lane. He wore a backpack and gloves and began strolling towards some fields near the other end of the park. A few minutes later, Anna and the boy who had called to her door entered the park and made their way towards a BMX trail. Around the same time, Geraldine tried to return Anna's earlier phone call. She was on the train home from her job. She worked as a senior manager in CIE. This time, it was Anna who didn't answer. By the time Geraldine turned the key at the door of their leak slip home, Anna and the boy were now walking across the park towards Lucan. They walked with a purpose, but lightly. A girl who saw them thought Anna had a sort of skippy jump walk. She saw Anna and the boy laughing and talking. On the far side of the bike track, the boy wearing the gloves was making his way through a field towards an old disused country manor called Glenwood House. It was built over 200 years before and had once been an elegant home on vast farmland. By 2018, it was a derelict, crumbling and filthy shell. The roof had collapsed in spots, exposing some of its old, tired beams to the elements. Crushed cans, broken bottles and syringes lay on filthy floors long stripped of carpets or wood. Walls were sprayed with graffiti and even satanic signs. Local young people would go there and hang out in the crumbling old house. Once inside, you were hidden from everyone else in the large park. A local man called Gerard Redmond was out walking his dog when he spotted the boy with gloves. He watched the boy drop down into a ditch and emerge on the far side. The boy in the gloves went through a hedge. He found a gap and looked as if he knew where he was going. The man thought the boy must have been taking a shortcut home. He saw the boy walking across the field towards the derelict house. The Creagel house was quiet when Geraldine arrived home. She asked where Anna was. Patrick told her that Anna had left with a boy. Geraldine was immediately concerned. It was not usual. Nobody called in for Anna. What was Anna doing with the boy, she asked. She told her husband, "That boy has nothing to do with her." Geraldine was always protective of her child. Her instinct was to immediately text Anna to tell her she was home. "Home now," she wrote. When there was no response a few minutes later, she decided to send another message. Patrick agreed. "Answer me now or I'm calling the police," she wrote. As she did it, she felt she was overreacting, but she was worried and becoming scared. It was 25 minutes past five, and Anna was not gone long. Still, there was no response from Anna, and Anna always answered her phone. Geraldine went into the park to search for Anna, following in the direction Patrick had seen her take with the boy. She couldn't find her. Patrick and Geraldine drove around the area, hoping they would find Anna on one of her long walks, but there was still no sign of her. Around 8 p.m., and desperately worried, they turned to John Cribben, a retired detective and family friend. They drove to his house. They told him that this was not how Anna behaved. She would never do this. He told them to go to the Garda station to report Anna missing. At 9:15 that evening, Anna's parents arrived at Leakslip Garda station. After explaining how Anna had left, Gardaí searched the Pulse computer system to find an address for the boy she was last seen with. About an hour and a half later, at 10:45 p.m, Gardaí arrived to the home of the boy who had called for Anna earlier that day. The boy's mother had just returned home from work and was putting her youngest child to bed when she heard the knock. Two uniformed Gardaí stood at the door. Garda Conor Muldoon told her about a missing teenage girl. He asked could they speak with her son, as he was believed to have seen her earlier that day. The boy stood behind his mother as the Garda asked if he knew Anna. He said he did. He had been with her in the park that afternoon. He had a brief chat with Anna, he told them. They headed for home, separately. He appeared surprised by it all. When the Gardaí left, the mother asked her son about the missing girl. She didn't recognize the name. The boy told her she was a girl from school. Didn't she remember, he asked. She told him no and asked an older son to show her a picture of Anna on Instagram. There were videos of the young girl singing, and the mother knew she had seen her around Leixlip village before. She knew now she would be able to help Gardaí if she did spot her again. That night, Geraldine and Patrick felt a deep, cold fear. They knew Anna must be in danger. They knew that someone or something had stopped her coming back to them. The search for Anna resumed the following morning. Gardaí called to the boy's house again. They wanted to know, was there anything he could tell them? This time, the boy told Sergeant John Dunn something more. Someone else had also met Anna that day. He explained he had called to Anna's house because a friend asked him to. Anna liked his friend, he said, but those feelings weren't reciprocated, and the friend felt Anna needed to hear this. The boy told the sergeant that he and Anna had met their friend, and after the other two spoke, they had all gone their separate ways, and he had returned home to finish his homework. The sergeant returned to the park to look over the area once more. What had he missed? Were there any clues along the route Anna and the boys had walked? He searched the railway line which ran alongside the park but found nothing. Sergeant Dunn and another colleague, Sergeant Angus Hussey, organised another walk of the route taken by the boys. This time both of the boys would join the Gardaí. As they started to walk, Sergeant Dunn noticed something else. The route the boys mentioned was wrong. It was different than the one the boy had initially said that they took. They continued for a bit before stopping near the BMX track in the park, and it was here something odd happened. The Gardaí noticed a look between the boys. It was fleeting, but there was something there. That quick look made the Gardaí wonder if the boys knew more. The two boys were now key witnesses. They might be able to piece together Anna's last known movements. With their parents, the boys went to make statements about the previous day. Both were questioned separately about their routes through the park. The boy who had called for Anna told Gardaí she had been very chatty. He said Anna wanted to know why his friend wanted to meet her. All three had met up and walked to a car park. The boy then left Anna and his friend to chat, and that was all. He returned home and only heard about Anna's disappearance when Gardaí called to his house that night. The boy's friend told Gardaí that he met the other boy and Anna in the park that early evening. The boys chatted about video games, and Anna looked at her phone. At one point, she asked him if he would go out with her. She had asked him before, too, and he had said no. That day, however, he didn't want to hurt her feelings. He was sorry, he told her, but he wasn't interested in her. Anna left. His friend left. And that was it. But he added more. He said after he left Anna, he had been attacked by two men. He told Gardaí they had grabbed and kicked him. One had a physique like a rugby player. He was winded from kicks to the chest, but said he had managed to deliver some punches back and get away. He held his arm and limped as he left the park. He got home around 6 o'clock and told his parents. When his father drove him back to the park to look for his attackers, a park ranger who met the pair said the boy didn't look well. The ranger used the words shook and like a rabbit caught in headlights to describe how he saw the boy. The boy was bruised. His right leg hurt badly and his lip had bled. Gardaí began an investigation into the attack on the boy. Detective Garda Gabrielle Newton, who was charged with investigating the attack on the boy, set about testing items belonging to him. She got the clothes and boots he had been wearing from his parents, as well as his phone. After showing Gardaí where he was attacked in St. Catherine's Park, the boy went to Garda headquarters in Phoenix Park, where he helped compile a photo fit of his attackers. Gardaí were in a tough spot. One of the last people to have seen Anna was this boy, and now he had been assaulted. They wondered if it had anything to do with Anna's disappearance. The following day, on May 16th, the first boy who had called to Anna's house spoke to a guidance counsellor at his school. The guidance counsellor had heard the boy was one of the last people to have seen Anna, but the boy insisted around 10 times that he wasn't. The boy told her that he had been dragged into this mess by his friend. He had already spoken to Gardaí 3 times. He said it was like an interrogation. He said he was stressed. He said calling for Anna that day was him doing a good turn for a mate. As he spoke, the guidance counsellor noticed he was clear, he was steady, and he made eye contact the whole time. By now, a large-scale operation was in place to find Anna. A missing person investigation was launched. Anna was wearing all black when last seen. Black runners, black bottoms, and a black hoodie. Anna's favourite hoodie. A photo of the smiling 14-year-old in these clothes was circulated to media outlets, and Anna's disappearance became a national story. Sightings began to flood in. People told Gardaí Anna had been seen in the departure area of Dublin Airport, in Dundrum in South Dublin, and in a nearby cul-de-sac on the morning of her disappearance. But none of these sightings were actually of Anna. The search then stepped up a gear. The Garda Sub-Aqua Unit explored the waters of the River Liffey, and a crime and security branch tracked mobile phone traffic from Monday the 14th, while 60 members of the civil defence combed the 200-acre park for any sign of Anna's whereabouts. Dogs and drones were also brought in to assist the search. Geraldine and Patrick continued searching and hoping they would find Anna, hoping they would hold her again. They couldn't imagine any other scenario. On Thursday the 17th of May, 3 days after Anna went missing, a small team were assigned to search an area near St. Catherine's Park. They would search old, decrepit buildings and a long, abandoned country manor. They walked towards Glenwood House, the run-down, dirty old building where one of the two boys was seen close to several days before. Taking small steps, they searched hedgerows and undergrowth as they approached the property. They read maps and followed a strict grid system to cover every patch of grass assigned to them as they neared the old period property. As they moved, they used slash hooks to clear the ground in front of them. Garda Sean White was the first officer on the team to reach the house. It was lunchtime, around 1 p.m. The house was dirty and in disrepair. Its roofing had caved in, and debris and rubbish littered its rooms. It was dark, except for small shafts of light leaking in through holes in the boarded-up windows. As he carefully navigated the dark old house, Garda White saw something. Something at the end of a corridor. He thought he might be looking at a mannequin. The colour was waxy, almost porcelain. He moved towards it. He noticed a strong smell. It was the stench of dried blood. He called out into the dark room, but there was no reply. If it wasn't a mannequin, he knew what lay in front of him must be something terrible. Within seconds he shouted, "Find!" That word meant one thing to everyone who heard it. A body. It was a female body. She was naked apart from black socks on her feet. There was something covering her face. It was hair, stuck to her face, as if she had been throwing her head side to side, as if she had struggled in her final moments. On the dirt floor among the dust, litter and ruin lay a body that had been brutally attacked and tortured. It was the body of a child. It was Anna. At 14 years old, Anna Creagel was dead. A team of forensic specialists were called in to examine the room and other parts of the house to try and piece together what had happened. A local doctor arrived to formally pronounce Anna's death. When Dr. Mohammed Wasif Ghaffar walked into the darkened room with only torchlight to illuminate his path, he found Anna covered in dust. Blue insulation tape was wrapped around her neck. She had three fingers inside it, an indication that she may have been trying to get it off. There was blood on her face and in her mouth. Her body was bruised. She had suffered multiple injuries. Anna was on her back and her head was bent backwards, almost like she had been pulled or dragged. Geraldine and Patrick Creagel's world fell apart that afternoon. Four dreaded words from Gardaí said it all. "We are so sorry." They knew all hope was gone. Their child, the center of their lives, their Anna, was gone. When state pathologist Dr. Mary Cassidy conducted an autopsy later that evening, she concluded that Anna had died from blunt force trauma to the head and neck. 60 areas of her body had injuries. Some of Anna's injuries led Dr. Cassidy to believe there had possibly been penetration or attempted penetration of Anna, although she could not be certain. As Gardaí shifted from a search for a missing child to a murder investigation, the work was just beginning for Garda technical and forensic teams. They had to piece together a picture of what had led to Anna's death in the most minute detail. They had to find and explain all that the naked eye couldn't make sense of. They identified and gathered as much evidence as they could. Anna's iPhone had been smashed, but every piece was painstakingly searched for and retrieved. Experts labored for 4 days and nights, recording every single item scattered around the room. They likened it to a skip. It was a house where every corner had been a place for late-night parties, drinking, drug-taking, illegal gatherings, and general antisocial behavior. There were cigarette butts, broken bottles, discarded cans, and rooms destroyed by fires. Decades of graffiti and neglect scarred the remaining walls. The technical bureau teams had to sift through it, searching for a needle in a haystack, with no idea if the needle existed. News quickly spread across the country of Anna's death. Shock and disbelief spread through communities as more details of Anna's final moments came to light. The leak-slip community was devastated. People questioned how such a crime could happen on their own doorsteps, in a public park like St. Catherine's Park, where families brought their children, where locals felt safe. On the 31st of May, the funeral of Anna Creagel took place at Newlands Cross Crematorium. Mourners wore bright clothes to celebrate the teenager, and gifts along with the Russian flag were draped across her coffin. Geraldine and Patrick Creagel couldn't speak that day. A pre-recorded poem called "Love Never Disappears" was played instead. Geraldine read the poem in English. Patrick spoke the words in French. Behind the scenes, Gardaí worked diligently to piece together their evidence. What had been gathered suggested the young girl had been beaten to the ground when she entered the room. Her clothes had been ripped off. The weapon used was most likely a heavy stick found close to her body. She had also been hit 4 times with a heavy object. A breeze block was found lying beside her body. The 9-inch concrete block had hair on it, Anna's hair. Then there was the struggle. It seemed Anna had been pulled towards what little light shone through the boarded-up window. There, she was sexually assaulted. But Anna had fought back. Her false nails lay scattered around the room. She had fought fiercely to survive. What this meant was that her assailant would likely have injuries too. Gardaí examined footage from the CCTV cameras around St. Catherine's Park. Garda Seamus Timmins gathered 700 hours of footage taken from cameras in the park and nearby housing estates. As he began to view the tapes, he saw the two boys who Gardaí believed were possibly the last to see Anna alive. As he watched, Garda Timmins could see that what the boys had told Gardaí about their movements that day was not the truth. He saw the boy walking to Anna's house shortly before 5 p.m. He saw Anna walking with him at 5:01. He saw the friend in another part of the park at 5:05. He was wearing gloves and carrying a backpack as he walked. 9 minutes later, at 5:14, he saw the boy and Anna walking across a field. Then, 35 minutes after that, at 5:49, the boy walking through the park, alone this time. 8 minutes after that, at 5:57, the friend could be seen. He was holding a bag in his hand. And 6 minutes later, at 6:03, the friend alone, limping through the park. And nothing to back up the claim of the friend that he had been the victim of an assault. Gardaí decided it was time to bring in the boys for questioning. But first, they waited in the hope of having some kind of evidence to prove at least one of the two had been at the house. In those same days, Gardaí investigating the boys' story of an attack had gone to the boys' home and taken items for examination in relation to that investigation. They had taken the boots he had worn that day and his phone. John Hode, a blood and DNA expert, had been tasked with examining the pair of Timberland boots worn by the boy. There were bloodstains on the boots. John Hode tested 9 different areas of bloodstaining and found that all matched Anna's DNA. As news of the breakthrough reached Gardaí, they decided it was time to bring the boys in for further interviews. They knew it would be unlike any other case they had ever experienced. The suspects were boys, children. They were just 13 years old. They would soon be known to the world as Boy A and Boy B. On the evening of the 23rd of May, the boys' parents were told their sons would be arrested the following day. Their parents brought them to separate Garda stations. The friend of the boy who had called to the Creagel house was interviewed at Clondalkin Garda station in West Dublin. He would become known as Boy A. His father and solicitor went with him to the Garda station, and a DNA sample was taken. The other boy was taken to Finglas Garda station. He would become known as Boy B. Because of his age, special arrangements were made to clear the station of all prisoners, to ensure the child couldn't encounter any adult prisoners. At the same time, Gardaí had search warrants for the boys' homes. Under strict orders from the judge who issued the warrant, they undertook the searches in a discreet manner, to avoid arousing local suspicion. Gardaí arrived in rental cars and in civilian clothes. Garda evidence bags were concealed inside black bags as Gardaí left the houses. Ahead of the interviews with the boys, the Gardaí who would sit across from them were acutely aware of a few things. It was inescapable to them, or anyone in the country, how much public feeling there was around this case. If Gardaí made some error that threw the case away, there would be no forgiveness. And they knew that with the suspects being children, if this case went to trial at court, then it was highly likely the defence barristers would do all they could to undermine the interviews and frame them as being intimidating or coercive for the young boys. They would do all they could to have the interviews ruled as inadmissible over how they were conducted and how any information was obtained. The detectives knew that the slightest misstep even one they didn't spot at the time, could lose the case. At this point, Gardaí had some evidence, but not an overwhelming amount. In the case of Boy A, there was some physical evidence, Anna's blood found on his boots. But in the case of Boy B, there was nothing to definitively link him to the crime scene. If they were going to be able to charge the boys with Anna's murder, the key to that would have to be found in these interviews. And so, the detectives entered the interview rooms in that summer heat and began their work. The Gardaí interviewing the boys would follow a specialized technique. The two detectives who interviewed Boy B were Detective Garda Donald Daly and Detective Inspector Damien Gannon. Daly had trained in interviewing techniques that enabled him to prepare meticulously for interviews like these, and also to go into them with a plan mapped out. From the outset, the interviewing technique plotted out how to approach a suspect or witness, and how to build a connection before gradually moving to more serious questions. The first time the detectives sat down with Boy B in the small interview room at Finglas Garda Station, they spoke for a long time before they got to discussing Anna Creagel or anything around her death. The boy was accompanied in the room by his solicitor and his mother. He held his mother's hand. Detective Daly and Boy B started by talking about the boy's interests, things like video games or comic book movies. Boy B liked Deadpool. He also liked Pokemon and Japanese cartoons, and he liked to make things with his hands. He wasn't a big fan of social media. The detectives noticed he had a wide vocabulary, wider than was typical for a 13-year-old. When they asked him if he understood what arrest meant, he told the detectives it meant that you were detaining me for something that I did or might have done. In the interview room, the boy was relaxed. He didn't seem at all disturbed by the situation he found himself in. If anything, it seemed like he was a bit bored. They would take plenty of breaks. Sometimes the boy would go with his mother to the vending machine and get a Ribena. Other times, he'd sit there fiddling with his shoe or stretch. He yawned as he waited for the interview to recommence after a break. Then, with the boy seemingly at ease, Detective Daly let him tell his story. The boy stuck to the story he had told up until then. He said Boy A asked him to call to Anna and ask her to meet him in the park. After the three had met, he had left them alone and gone home to do his homework. He insisted he knew nothing else. Gardaí pointed out that the route he said he had taken through the park that day did not match up with the CCTV footage they had. The boy paused, thought it over, then shifted his story slightly to fit with the CCTV. He didn't panic, and the detectives didn't push. Not too hard. Not yet. Gardaí told the boy they had found a roll of blue insulation tape at his home. He said he used it when making things. Then detectives showed him a photo of the blue tape found around Anna's neck. The exact same, specialized and rare type of insulation tape. He said, "Wait a minute. Holy shit. Oh my God." He said he had given Boy A that tape. In Clondalkin Garda Station, Gardaí interviewing Boy A took a similarly patient approach. He told the detectives he liked drawing anatomy, the human body. He had an interest in the human body in general. Like Boy B, Boy A seemed calm. He too stuck to the story given to Gardaí already. That changed when Detective Garda Thomas Doyle informed him about the forensic evidence Gardaí had discovered. Anna's blood on his boots. The boy reacted by asking, "Are you joking? You can't be serious." He asked for some air and Gardaí paused the interview. They brought him a glass of water. When they resumed, D. Garda Doyle told him that the only possible explanation for him having Anna's blood on his boots was if he had been in the room where she was killed. So he asked, was he in that room? Boy A replied simply saying, no. While the forensic evidence was significant, Boy A did not waver from his story, even after learning about it. The boys slept in the Garda stations overnight, between their interviews. Gardaí made up beds for them and their parents. Through four interviews, Boy B denied knowing what had happened to Anna. In the fourth interview, when asked why he had continued to claim he had taken a particular route through the park when the CCTV showed he had not, the boy said he had been confused and then afraid to admit to not telling the truth. And then something changed. Gardaí had continued to search for witnesses and had found one who had seen Boy B walking towards Glenwood House on the day Anna was murdered. In their fifth interview with Boy B, Gardaí told him he could now be placed at the murder scene. Boy B replied that he had been in the field, but only to look around. He said he had not been in the house. The detectives were frustrated. They had interviewed Boy B for over 10 hours and were growing weary of his continuing denials and the way he would shift his story as needed. Detective Garda Daly said to the boy, "You're making this up as you go along. You're changing your story to suit. You can't keep doing this. You owe it to everyone to start telling the truth here." He asked his mother to leave the room. Detective Daly said that he was required to have a guardian present. The boy's solicitor asked for a break. The boy spoke. He said he had been in the house with Anna, but he had left. He said his friend, Boy A, had gone into the house with Anna. After that, he heard a scream, a strong scream. He thought someone had attacked Boy A and Anna, he said. But he was sure Boy A could protect her. And then the scream grew muffled. He said it sounded like Anna's mouth had been covered. After he spoke, Boy B began to cry. And so did his mother. After a break of half an hour, Boy B told Gardaí he wanted to tell them more. He said he had seen Boy A flip Anna onto the ground, then choke her. He had seen Boy A start to strip her clothes off. Boy B said, "It looked horrifying." Gardaí interviewing Boy A were not achieving any similar kind of breakthrough. Even after facing the forensic evidence, he replied, "No comment" to most of their questions. The detectives knew they needed more. Gardaí and Finglas printed off a transcript of Boy B's fifth interview, including his admission that he had been at the house and had heard Anna's screams. They sent the pages to Clondalkin Garda Station. They hoped learning Boy B was starting to tell more of the story might motivate Boy A to talk too. They read the transcript to him. He replied, "Boy B is lying." On the 25th of May, Boy A was charged with the murder of Anna Criejo. When they searched Boy A's home, they had found a backpack in his bedroom. Inside were knee pads, gloves, shin guards, a snood scarf, and a skull-shaped mask that covered the top half of the face. The mask was homemade and skin-coloured. There were fangs cut into it. They were painted red to make it look blood-stained. The two boys had made it in school for Halloween. On that mask and on the backpack, knee pads and gloves, forensic specialists would find Anna's blood. On Boy A's phone, Gardaí found almost 12,500 images, most of which were pornographic. There were searches for child porn, horse porn, and animal porn. There were internet searches for horror stories and knives. There was a screenshot of a YouTube search for videos on torture methods. There was an internet search for abandoned places in Lucan. Gardaí also found a copybook with rules for a satanic cult in his bedroom. It listed Boy A and Boy B as members. Boy B insisted the cult was a homework club and a harmless joke among friends. Crucially, further forensic testing discovered traces of semen on Anna's top. The DNA matched Boy A. With that, he was charged with aggravated sexual assault, along with the previous murder charge. Gardaí were able to bring Boy B back in for further questioning. It was on July 8th when Detectives Daly and Gannon again sat across from Boy B. This time, Boy B had much more to tell them. He had admitted he had seen Boy A wearing the homemade mask. The zombie mask, he called it. He said Boy A had been wearing it when he attacked Anna. He again insisted he had not taken part in the attack. Then he went further. He said Boy A had asked him if he wanted to kill somebody, roughly a month before Anna was murdered. He had said no. Boy A had said, "Oh, come on." Boy B asked him who he wanted to kill. Boy A had replied, "Anna Creasia." Boy B said he had taken it as a joke at the time. The detectives did not believe him. They were now sure he knew what Boy A intended to do that day, and his own words had just proved it. 3 days later, on the 12th of July, Boy B was charged with Anna's murder. When the case reached court, they would be formally labelled Boy A and Boy B, as their identities were to be protected, for fear of public anger against their families if their names were revealed. They were the youngest people in the history of the state to have been charged with murder. On the 30th of April 2019, Court 9 in the Central Criminal Court on Dublin's Parkgate Street opened for the trial of Boy A and Boy B for the murder of Anna Creasia. The case had been rushed to reach trial far more quickly than was normal. Gardaí had prioritised it, getting analysis of evidence done in days. The trial would be heard in an adult court, as the charges were too serious for the children's court. Smaller changes were made to the usual process of a murder trial too, to take into account the young ages of the accused. The public gallery was closed, and a strict ban was put on anyone, inside the court or anywhere else, publicly identifying the accused. Boy A and Boy B had separate teams of lawyers defending them. The prosecution would argue Boy A had sexually assaulted and murdered Anna, and Boy B had lured her to the abandoned house, knowing what Boy A was planning to do. While there was significant forensic evidence against Boy A, the case against Boy B was not clear-cut. The prosecution knew the trial would hinge on one or two small but critical factors if they were to secure a guilty verdict. There was no conclusive evidence at all that he had taken part in the murder, or that could prove that when he called to Anna's home he was aware of Boy A's plans. There were witnesses who had seen him close to the house, but beyond that, not much else, except for his own words. Those interviews with Gardaí in Finglas Garda Station were now the prosecution's best and perhaps only hope of a conviction. Both Boy A and Boy B pled not guilty. The trial would last 6 weeks. On the first day of the trial, one journalist noted the accused dressed as though they could be attending their confirmation. The boys, now both 14 years old, sat at the back of the court. They sat apart, each with their parents. As they watched the case laid out against them for murder, Boy B held his mother's hand, while Boy A leaned against his father, resting on his shoulder. Geraldine and Patrick Creagel attended every day of the trial. They wanted to be present for every moment. Geraldine jotted notes of all that was said. Anna's parents would be two of the first witnesses called to testify. When Anna's father addressed the court in that first week of the hearing, Patrick Creagel talked about his last day with his daughter. She was a very happy child, he said, but there had been problems with bullying. He told the court about Anna, including her difficulties in life and the beauty of her personality, which nobody knew like he and her mother. Geraldine Creagel spoke of her daughter, who loved to dance, travel, and spend time with her parents. She too spoke of Anna's darker times. She admitted she worried for her daughter. Anna was vulnerable, she said, and that made her a potential target among her peers. The testimony of her parents helped to put a face to her name. The defence's strategy wasn't clear early on. The barristers, Patrick Gageby for Boy A and Damien Colgan for Boy B, rarely cross-examined witnesses. The prosecution played the entirety of the footage of Boy B's interviews, all 16 hours. This is an unusual tactic. Typically, selected portions of interview transcripts are read aloud to the court. But in this case, the prosecution felt the jury had to see how Boy B's story had shifted and changed over the course of 8 interviews. They wanted the jury to hear his voice and see his face as he told Gardaí his story and then altered it. The jury watched the 13-year-old boy responding calmly and confidently to Garda questioning. They saw him fidget and yawn during breaks, and they saw him express shock as evidence was shown to him, like the blue tape around Anna's neck. Some observers in court would later say his shocked reactions came across as bad acting. The jury, watching the tapes, saw Boy B's mother move slightly away from his side in the interview room as the questions grew more serious. They watched as the boy went from initially denying he had any knowledge of what had happened to Anna to later admitting he had seen Boy A's brutal attack. In the case of Boy B, the critical question became if he knew Boy A intended to kill Anna. To prove that, the prosecution pointed to a short portion on one of his later interviews, when he had told Gardaí about a conversation he had had with Boy A a month before Anna's murder. Boy A asked him if he wanted to kill Anna Creagel. Boy B had told Gardaí at the time he said he wanted no part in it. But Gardaí believed he knew Boy A was serious, and the prosecution told the jury the same. Whether the jury believed Boy A saw the remark as a joke or a serious statement of intent could decide the entire case. As one of those interview videos were being played, Boy B had a panic attack in the courtroom. He was seen by a doctor, and the court was adjourned for the day. While Boy B had admitted lying to Gardaí in his earlier interviews, his legal team sought to introduce expert testimony to raise doubts about why he had lied. They had Dr. Colm Humphreys, a clinical psychologist, who examined the Garda interview tapes and meet with Boy B. With the jury removed from the court, he delivered his findings. His impression upon meeting the boy was that he was friendly and polite. He was a pleasant lad, Humphrey said. He diagnosed Boy B as suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Humphreys believed Boy B had shut down under questioning and was struggling to process his memories of the day. The lies and the shifting story, he concluded, did not make the boy guilty. He was an intelligent child, but an immature one, Humphrey said. He felt the boy was naive and had been easily led and didn't know what would happen to Anna that day. Boy B's defence team wanted Dr. Humphreys to present his findings to the jury, but the prosecution argued he would be effectively deciding for the jury why Boy B had lied to Gardaí and declaring that Boy B had no knowledge of Boy A's plan. They argued that this would be as good as making Dr. Humphreys the 13th member of the jury. Justice Paul McDermott heard the arguments and decided he would have to take the night to consider them. When court resumed the following morning, he ruled that the doctor's findings could not be put before the jury. Other evidence presented by the prosecution included footage from the CCTV images of the boys that day in the park, and the testimony of Gardaí who had spoken with them in the first days after Anna had gone missing. Jurors were shown items and images from the abandoned old house, including blood-stained clothing, a blood-splattered wall, and Anna's now familiar black hoodie. The room where Anna died was presented to the jury using a 3D program, a computer-generated reconstruction of that dark and dirty place where Anna took her final breath. Witnesses recounted their stories of Anna and Boy B that day in the park. One 15-year-old girl saw the pair in a sort of skippy jump walk, and they seemed to be getting along. There was also evidence that jurors would never see, including the sexual and violent images found on Boy A's phone. The court did hear about how Boy A's internet search history showed he had looked up abandoned places in Lucan. They heard about the copybook found in Boy B's bedroom containing a satanic pledge that was part of a satanic cult, and how Boy A carried a backpack to the house that day with a zombie-type mask inside. John Hode, the forensic scientist who had tested Boy A's clothing, wanted to show a mannequin dressed in the zombie mask, shin guards, knee pads, and gloves worn by Boy A. Some of the items had Anna's blood on them. But the defense argued against it being used, that there was no proof to show Boy A was dressed like that on the day Anna died. The forensic evidence against Boy A was overwhelming, the prosecution argued. State pathologist Mary Cassidy had explained how Anna's body lay in dirt and dust when she was found, how multiple injuries could have caused her death, how Anna's skull and neck were badly damaged. Defence teams made their closing statements for the two boys on the 10th of June 2019. Boy A was from a hard-working family, his defence barrister said. They were decent people. He asked the jury to be mindful of the boy's age when reaching the verdict. Young people of that age have an immaturity, he said. Is there any real evidence that he planned any of this? He asked the jury. He argued the case was based almost entirely on circumstantial evidence, but nothing certain. Boy B's defence suggested he had been set up by Boy A. Trauma and shame could explain Boy B's lying, they argued. They asked if, knowing of Boy A's intentions, he would have walked with Anna through a public park with CCTV cameras. They asked if they thought Boy B would be that stupid. And finally, they argued, if the jury did not believe Boy B had knowledge of Boy A's plan to kill Anna, then he must be found not guilty. On the 18th of June 2019, after 14 and a half hours of deliberations, the jury had reached their verdict. With a shaking hand, the forewoman of the jury handed over the verdict to the registrar. Geraldine Creagel closed her eyes. Patrick Creagel held onto his wife. The registrar read out the jury's verdict. The verdict was unanimous. Both Boy A and Boy B were guilty. They had murdered Anna Creagel. Geraldine and Patrick cried. When Boy B heard the verdict, he turned to his mother and asked, "I'm guilty?" "Yes, they found you guilty." His father held his son's hand and kissed it. Boy A's father put his arm around his son. Geraldine and Patrick held each other's hands and hugged family and friends around them. The 14-year-old boys were led away to begin their jail terms at Oberstown Children's Detention Campus. In her victim impact statement, Geraldine spoke of the unbearable pain the family now suffered without their precious child. She spoke of the agony they lived with every day, knowing the fear Anna must have felt in her final moments. Before starting secondary school, Anna wrote a paragraph on her hopes and dreams for the future. Geraldine shared those aspirations. Anna wrote of many plans for life, from the grand to the simple, but ultimately she wanted two very simple things in her life. Anna wrote, "I hope that I have a good life. I hope that everyone I meet will be nice." Geraldine finished her statement by thanking Anna for her precious love. "We miss you. We love you. No one can take that away from us." Boy A was sentenced to life with a review after 12 years. Boy B was sentenced to 15 years. Patrick Criegel died in June of 2022, just over 4 years after Anna's murder. At his funeral, mourners heard how he simply couldn't bear the pain of losing his child. Every waking hour for the Criegels was a reminder that Anna was never coming home. They could never hold her again. They would never hear her at night telling them to sleep well, and that she loved them both. A slideshow of pictures was shown at the funeral. Pictures of Patrick and his family, pictures of Patrick and Anna. The murder of Anna Criegel was one of the most deeply investigated and covered cases the country has ever known. And yet, no cause was ever identified. Why would two 13-year-old boys murder? And why did they choose Anna? No motive was ever found. Former state pathologist Mary Cassidy, who saw Anna's body in that abandoned house, would never forget what she had seen. She said, "I've seen a lot of things, but there was something about that. Children killing children. If that's what society has become, I need out." Boy A and Boy B are still serving their sentences. They are now adults in their 20s. Boy A has been moved to an adult's prison, and his name is on the sex offender's register. But they will never be named. And while they will one day walk free, what they did as children to Anna Criegel will never be forgotten. Thank you for listening to this episode of Lines of Inquiry. We now have an email address, linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com, and we would love to hear from you, so get in touch. Whether you have a story you think we should cover, or just want to let us know how you felt about an episode, that email is linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com. If you're listening on Spotify, please leave a comment on this episode and let us know what you think of the podcast. We really appreciate those who have taken time to give the podcast a review, and we are now approaching 4,000 five-star ratings on Spotify, and I am genuinely humbled by the support. Thank you. That generous support helps us to tell these stories. If you haven't yet rated the podcast, I would be grateful if you could give us a five-star rating wherever you're listening, sharing it on your story on Instagram, or simply telling a friend that you're listening to the podcast. Make sure to like or follow the podcast in your podcast app and hit the notifications button so you'll know every time a new episode is released. Lines of Inquiry is presented by me, John Sweetman. The podcast is created by Darren Cleary. Our executive producer is Owen Brennan. Our producers are Siobhan Maguire and Siobhan Walsh. Sound editing and design by Neil Kavanagh, with additional editing support from Ed Smith. Social media, marketing, video, and legal support comes from the Go Loud team. This episode was written by Siobhan Maguire and Owen Brennan, with script editing from Owen Brennan. In the end, everything done in the dark comes to light.